Hello, Philip.
Hello, Rachel. How are you today?
I'm doing good. The rain's ha come, so it's a bit less humid, and now I'm a happy person.
Well, there it is, folks, your weekly weather report. We hope you enjoyed the show. It was either this or Facebook if you wanted to know what the weather's doing, because no one likes to open a window anymore.
No, you never know what might fly in. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Very good. I've got an exciting weekend ahead. This is, I guess, the most Jewish thing that's going to happen to me this week. My nephew's bar mitzvah. So lots of excitement. It starts tomorrow night, or I guess tonight, if you're listening to this as the podcast comes out. Friday night, then we've got Saturday morning, then we've got lunch, and then we got Sunday night for the party, because no bar mitzvah can last a day anymore. We have to spread it out. So I'm very excited. It's going to be very cool. We've got family come over from Israel for it, which is very exciting to have them as well. And yeah, I'm sure my nephew is going to be absolutely amazing.
Mazel tov to all your family, especially your parents.
Yeah, and everyone stood that. I mean, what have we done, really? He's doing the hard work, and we're very proud of him. His name's Rafi. He's going to be absolutely devastated that he got a shout out. But it's nice for me because I will get to take part in all the festivities, but I also get to gig this weekend because I've managed to orchestrate things so that I can still work as well.
Excellent.
And then coming back Sunday for the party.
What kind of party is it? Are they having a themed
It's a bar
party?
mitzvah party.
And that's it. That's not like a. I went to a Parks and Recreation bar mitzvah party once, and I've not seen the show, so I can only assume by the fact that a few people found everything amazing, it was a very accurate portrayal.
So it's not often I would use this platform of ours to plug a show, but Parks and Recreation is fantastic. Also interesting, actually, I've just started watching Community, which is another American sitcom, and there is a character in it called Annie, who just randomly in one episode they announced that she's Jewish, and it's like they suddenly decided we need to give each of the characters specifics. So they've got a Christian, they've got a Jehovah's Witness, they've got this Jewish
Right.
character, and the actress is Jewish as well, so it's it ties in. And actually they just had an episode where she gave a bit of her background, which is that her mum's Jewish, her dad wasn't, and I think that's even true to her as well. So
I don't normally plug shows either on here, but I'm going to now that you've said that.
I don't think the Chicken Soup Diaries counts as a TV show.
I think I should actually write that TV show. No, it's called Kid Sister, and it's a sitcom from New Zealand about a Jewish family. And you know how, like, we say this show is unapologetically Jewish? I mean, this does not even begin to compare to that unapologetically Jewishness of Kid Sister, because it was a mainstream sitcom on ordinary telly, and it's this family. They use Hebrew or Yiddish expressions where we would use them. There's no translation unless you've got the subtitles on. There's just the assumption that an intelligent audience will pick up from the context what people mean. And my favorite moment is when the mum, who's South African, instead of saying OMAG or Oh My Actual God, she says Oh My Actual Hashem. And I thought that was brilliant. So, yeah, that's my TV. Well, what a new show we're doing. Weather reports, TV recommendations.
We're here for everything. We are your guides to whatever it is that's Jewish around the world. But yeah, bar mitzvahs. So the most Jewish thing that's going to happen to me currently is a lovely catch up with my Israeli side of the family, and also the bar mitzvah, which looking forward to immensely. How about you, Rachel? Most Jewish thing that's happened or happening to you?
I had a gig a couple of weeks ago at a club called Comedy Under Siege, run by Ashley Hayden, and it was a really fun gig. It was a usual and it's usually a really fun gig. It was a bit of an odd night because the audience was a slightly strange dynamic, because there were about six people who'd been before, and then the whole rest of the audience was a group of Chinese students, like foreign exchange students, who had been brought by their tutor to experience a London comedy club. And they were very sweet, like, and really lovely, but I think they found it incredibly bewildering. They left in the interval, and then I was first on after the interval. And out of the people who remained, the front three people all turned out to be from, like, my original neck of the woods in Essex. And on further questioning, one of them grew up on the council estate where I grew up, and literally his house backed onto where my house was. And I started doing my material, which I've mentioned here before, that I've got about how when I was young, the National Front, who were like the big racist party before the BNP, they kind of had a big base on the estate and they used to protest against the community and throw stones at our synagogue and all this kind of stuff. So I started doing that material and we were all had a good old laugh. And then I went and did my new material, which was fine. And at the end of the evening, this guy came up to me and he said, you know what, I remember when I was growing up, like, he's not Jewish, the guy, and he's a few years older than me, but he said, I remember actually those marches. I remember the big protests and how they used to come and march around the area where the synagogue was and shout stuff and be really racist. He said, obviously I was a kid, I didn't really understand it, but now you've mentioned it, it was quite a traumatic memory of my childhood. And I said, it's funny because I've been doing it so long as part of my stand-up in a kind of reclaiming it for myself story, that it doesn't feel real anymore. It feels like something that couldn't possibly have happened. So it was so validating for this guy to sort of tell me that he remembered it happening in real life.
I'm so glad that the outcome of that story was that he remembered it as a witness and not, oh, yeah, I was waving the flag. I, you know, even at a young age, I was like, Jews out, you know.
I remember my best bit was when I smashed an egg over some little blonde girl. No, it was, it was a very supportive conversation and it was really nice. And it's funny because in this week's episode, that comes up, the experience of coming to live in this area and then being sort of quite persecuted for my ethnicity.
The start of a beautiful lifelong journey, it would appear.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the episode. We should say right off the bat that the episode that you're about to hear does contain discussion of mental health and suicide, which some listeners may find distressing. We wanted to share that with you first of all. Who have we got, Rachel?
We've got the fabulous beatboxer SK Shlomo, who is a huge presence every year at the Edinburgh Fringe and performs all around the world.
It was a fascinating conversation. We touched on loads of different topics, different subjects, some similarities to previous guests as well in terms of Jewish foods they might like or Jewish memories. But I think that's the joy of what we do, that actually there's so much crossover sometimes that it really does highlight how much of a traditional people we can be.
I mean, also, we don't always know, I was just thinking this today, actually, we don't always know everybody's Jewish background when we book them. Like, we might know them from particular contexts, but we haven't said, where were your grandparents from? We don't send out that kind of level. We don't get them to do a DNA test or anything before they come on. So it's really interesting that we've got one after the other that have quite a similar background, but their approach to it is maybe quite different. And also with Shlo, their experiences are very painful often in terms of how people have responded to their heritage. Yeah, it's an interesting diversion from the usual sort of super bantsy maybe episode that we've done before.
Absolutely. And I think we are incredibly grateful at how open and frank Shlo was with us. Hopefully what the episode highlights and talks about is all relevant, relatable topics that people will find interesting to listen to. I do like the idea that we could maybe do a DNA test in order to choose our guests from now on. And maybe part of the show, we should have the reveal. You know, it's a bit like the Jeremy Kyle of the show where they don't know what it's going to be. And then we've got the DNA test and it turns out they're not Jewish. And we have to can the whole episode.
I mean, it would be really, really embarrassing if that was one of us.
Oh, can you imagine?
We have imagine what happened to my branding. Like, everything about who I am is like based on this.
You'd be like, I'm Orthodox. What? And I say, actually, you're not. You're not a Jew. you're a fraud is what you are.
What would I do? What would be the first thing that I would do?
I don't know, but I have to say, I do think the biggest crime that Jewish people are statistically in prison for is fraud. So really, you would just be even more on brand. I should also confess to listeners that I had huge issues with my connectivity during the record. So I do disappear a couple of times. You handle it beautifully. You carry on the conversation and then I come back and almost ruin the vibe immediately.
But reappearing like the genie from the bottle.
Exactly. But hopefully it won't disturb the episode too much. But just to be aware, this is the issue you have when you're recording remotely with people all over the world, or in this case, North London.
So as I go into this episode with SK Shlomo, just a quick reminder that we do discuss issues around mental health and suicide, which some of you might find distressing. We wish you all a Shabbat Shalom and take care. Enjoy the episode.
Hello, I'm Philip Simon.
And I'm Rachel Krieger. We are two Jewish comedians.
I'm Reform, so if I went to Glastonbury, I could probably only last a day in a field.
And I'm Orthodox, so if I went to Glastonbury, I'd have to go for longer, as I keep at least 2 days for any festival.
In each episode of the show, we chat to our favourite Jews about their lives and experiences growing up, and how much Jewishness plays a part.
Are they goodbye yellow brick roads, or, hey, what a schlep, I'm calling an Uber.
Welcome to Jew Talk Enemy.
Let's introduce our guest, international beatbox star, disability and mental health ambassador, former world looping champion and 3 times TED speaker, it's SK Shlomo.
Hello.
What a lovely intro. I feel well posh now.
Do you?
There's some absolute gibberish about me on like Wikipedia. There's some stuff on Wikipedia and it's been verified by like reference to the BBC, and it just drives me mad. Like someone once said as a joke in an interview that I could speak like 3 different languages, Hebrew, Aramaic and Arabic, and then that got somehow got onto Wikipedia, and then on BBC radio they said it out loud, and then it become like verified, and I'm like, you really mustn't believe anything you read. It's just mostly nonsense.
Is that the weirdest thing that you've seen written about you?
No, I have seen all kinds of shocking and weird things written about me. Most recently, someone writing that trans people shouldn't be around young people because they're probably groomers. I'm like, what does that even say about the person who wrote that? But anyway.
There's a lot of that stuff about, I don't know, my husband and his friends, they created a really beautiful children's Grace After Meals booklet with a cartoon picture of a little girl washing her hands in a ritual way before you eat on Sabbath. And it's a cartoon little girl with sort of t-shirt on. And there was complaints from some people, religious people, about the length of her sleeves, that her sleeves should go below the elbow. And we did all think to ourselves, if you are so attracted to a cartoon picture of a little girl because of the length of her sleeves, your problems aren't religious. Do you know what I mean?
Like that's
there's a bigger issue there.
Surely their biggest issue is a woman being involved in any kind of ritual. I thought you were going to say it was outrageous that a woman was washing her hands and not a man washing. Are they okay with that?
Well, they have to be. They're allowed to print the booklet. I think in the end they did lengthen the sleeves a tiny bit, but not below the it all got very political and really bizarre. So yeah, but at least, you know what, at least being told that you speak 3 languages is complimentary. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's wrong, but at least it's not hurtful.
Well, regular listeners to the podcast will know that we always like to find out how our guests self-define as Jews. So you already know I'm Orthodox, Philip's Reform, but Shlo, what kind of a Jew are you?
I'm Jewish. Jewish. There you go. I identify with a lot of the cultural sides of being a Jew, but I would not describe myself as religious. I'm firmly agnostic. But I guess I went to Reform Shul, Maidenhead Synagogue. They got Rabbi Romaine.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I did a bar mitzvah, but my family never really identified much with the sort of beliefs, more in the value of the culture, like, you know, Friday night dinner. And I don't know, there's so many amazing parts of the cultural tradition, like how Jewish people look after each other when someone's died, things like that. I just think just make perfect sense to me. So I don't know, I was kind of raised to take what works and don't feel bad about the rest. So that's the kind of Jew I identify as.
That's a great answer. And Friday night dinner is the best bit. I don't think everyone would agree with that. Who wouldn't agree?
I think that's a very relatable answer as well, because I think most of us would probably think about those life stages, whether it's a weekly Shabbat meal or whether it's when someone dies and the community coming together. So lovely.
Yeah, that's when you feel Jewish. And like, I remember my grandmother, like, this memory really clearly, this is one of my earliest kind of understandings of the sort of the flexibility of tradition and faith. And my grandmother took one of my crisps and she was like, oh, it's delicious. What flavour is it? And I was like, oh, smoky bacon. She went, oh, darling, why did you have to tell me? And I'm like, what do you mean? Why do I have to tell you? So if I hadn't told you, you'd just carry on eating them. And it's like, okay, yeah, you keep kosher, but do you know what I mean? It's flexible.
In fairness, that probably had never been near a pig. It was...
Yeah. What? I don't think Walker's crisps have got meat in them. Yeah.
It's vegetarian. It's fine. They've got the V on the sticker on it. So It's fine.
I remember when I was a kid, I don't know if this is an Essex thing or an everywhere thing. I never know about these things. You tell me, but when I was a kid, we had hedgehog flavour crisps.
Really?
I don't remember what brand it was.
As in like hedgehog meat, or is it like
that was what they were called, hedgehog flavour crisps. They tasted kind of barbecue-y. They weren't like spiky or anything. They didn't curl up into a ball, but they were like, everyone ate them because obviously the likelihood of them containing literal hedgehog was quite small. But also they sold them in the health food shop, so the assumption was that they were vegetarian. So they were like super popular with the kind of nominally, like, I don't know if I would say kosher, but not eating not kosher people.
Yeah, kosher hedgehog.
But that's quite an extreme. I mean, you've gone from sort of Walkers to roadkill in one very, very easy step.
Yeah, they're sort of tomato-y, barbecue-y. I don't know. I don't know what a hedgehog would taste like. I've not eaten one in real life. But yeah, that was the trend. And also my big passion when I was young was Frazzles, which were, I don't know if that's the crisps you're talking about, but because they didn't contain anything that wasn't kosher. And when my family was on the cusp of becoming like super religious, they were sort of my regret. And then I found that smoky Bisley can almost replace the flavour a little bit.
I know, it's all synthetic, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all... That's why it's so delicious.
Yeah, that is very true. So obviously passing bacon crisps to your grandmother is one thing, but what's the most Jewish thing that's happened to you lately?
Well, I think for me, like, I started being a bit more open about my identity. I made this show, a solo piece called Breathe, and it sort of tells my story with all forms of my identity. So in the show, I'm talking about being queer and I'm talking about being disabled. But it's the first time I ever really spoke on stage about some of the trickier sides of being Jewish. Like, I've often like recreated scenes from my childhood with, like, because my grandmother's side is Sephardi, so there's like belly dancing and Arabic food and all this kind of joyful side that I've talked about in my work. But I'd never really talked about kind of handling racism and, you know, judgment and wanting to hide that kind of Jewish or immigrant side of my identity, because my skin's really pale. I'm very, very white for an Arab. I'm the whitest in my sort of extended family. So where like other members of my family will suffer racism from strangers on the street, I kind of learnt quite young, like probably too young to even really try and you know, much younger than I ever should have known about this kind of stuff. But I realized that I could get away with it. I could hide my Arabic background and sort of pass as white. So in the show, it's lovely really talking about it, because my mother gave all of her children white first names, right? So my middle name, Shlomo, was originally my middle name. I've now changed it by default to be my first name. But I had this white first name. So did my siblings, because my mother never had a middle name, just had a very, very, very Hebrew first name, Irit. When she arrived in the UK, she was 7 years old. She didn't speak any English. It sounds like it was really traumatic for her, just being so clearly foreign. So she really insisted that we all had a name that would let us fit in and just sort of appear normal in this culture. But, you know, for me, it was like a real big step to sort of reclaim Shlomo, like the most Jewish name in the world. But like, people over here don't know that. They think it's like a really cool techno hip hop name. And people are like, oh, what's your real name? What's your real name? I'm like, no, Shlomo is my real name. They're like, no, don't be silly. I'm like, no, it's kind of racist to say that is my name. Like, so I don't know. And then talking about that in the show, it's been really so beautiful, because the number of people who've come up to me afterwards, after the show, I always do a signing. I always want to meet all the audience and people coming up to me and introducing themselves by a very, very, very foreign name. Yeah, so my name is, and they tell me their real name, but they're like, but no one knows that. I've probably two or three people know that apart from my family. I just go by Rosie or whatever. And they're like crying because they've experienced the same thing as me. I think that's the most Jewish thing that's happened to me lately, is just reclaiming it a little bit and owning that.
It sounds like you found it really liberating.
Yeah, it is. It's like, I think what I learned as a child was to hide my identity out of fear. Like, I didn't know that at the time. I didn't have that kind of emotional literacy at the time to name that. It was just how I coped. I'd hide being foreign. I'd hide what I didn't know back then was my disability. I'd conform and blend in. And I'd join in with the homophobic comments, and I'd join in with everything just to keep myself safe. And then I think I actually had to get into a really bad way with my mental health, which is another thing I talk about in the show. Like, I was suicidal. I had to get to that rock bottom emergency place for me to then decide, A, I'm going to stay on this planet, because I've got two beautiful children who need that parent. And B, I'm going to have to basically completely rebuild myself cell by cell and just delete all of this toxic, hateful language that we absorb from childhood and totally becomes ingrained in who we are. We talk to ourselves in these awful ways. So I was like, right, I'm done. I am done with faking who I am, and I'm done with being afraid of what might happen to me if people know I'm Jewish, or people know I'm disabled, or people know that I'm non-binary. No, whatever, have it. Say what you've got to say. Attack me if you've got to attack me. I will not be afraid, because otherwise I'm teaching my children fear, and I just don't want that.
I massively relate to what you're saying, because I also have hidden disabilities. I'm also super white passing from an immigrant family. And where I grew up was full of the National Front, which is like their pre-runners to the BNP. And they were the only people who would recognise that you could be a little white blonde girl, but you could be a Jew. And I experienced a lot of quite similar things.
All four of my grandparents were refugees, right? So they're escaping like actual life and death trauma, where you do not show vulnerability. You do not show weakness. The stoic forward-thinking approach is literally survival. So there's no way you'd describe yourself voluntarily as disabled or struggling with mental health or any form of weakness, because, you know, that generation was programmed to just survive, just keep the kids safe, just keep going. And then they've kind of landed here in the UK where, there is still the National Front. There is still danger, but it's a different type of danger. So I get it, like, why the older generation still holds on to, like, fears. If you think of, like, the word homophobia in its most literal sense, or transphobia in its most literal sense, like, phobia, like, you're afraid. It's not that you're hating on, necessarily. You don't mean to hate on trans people or homosexual people, or it's that you're afraid to even look at the fact that that exists, because you're scared it's going to affect your safety.
I hard relate.
See, I found growing up, we were openly Jewish. We were a reform family. We went to shul. We did on the youth groups and things like that. But I remember being at college, and I was at drama school. One of my teachers, he wanted to know if the reason I was sometimes, I guess, scared to stand up and be seen, counted, or was because I was Jewish. And it never even occurred to me that was a thing. I didn't think I was ever holding back. I was never secretive about being Jewish. There was an Israeli teacher in one of the classes, and I remember looking over his shoulder and reading the notes he was making about us in Hebrew. And being open about that. You know, I couldn't understand it all, but I knew the gist of what he was writing, and that, you know, I was openly Jewish. It wasn't anything I hid at all. But it was such an odd statement that this teacher said. It wasn't in a class. We were just walking along. So it was this in passing. So he wasn't trying to trigger a deeper conversation.
Was this teacher Jewish?
No. Just, I guess, old school. But it's really stuck with me. This is now over 20 years ago, and it stuck with me.
That's racism. That is such a strange thing to say. If you're trying to lift a young person up, you do not say it in that way. You say positive things about, like, platforming them and building them up. You don't go, oh, is this the reason you're like, oh, I'm sorry that happened to you. That's
But see, I've never considered it to be racist. I mean, you're saying it now, and you're...
Wait, well, let's just change it. Imagine if you'd said to someone from an Afro-Caribbean background, is it because you're black that you never try hard enough? You don't think that would be racist?
But the not trying hard enough, I guess, is my interpretation of what he meant by it. It's only when I'd have to have the conversation with him. But I didn't feel threatened by him in any way in that conversation. It was just in his mind, one of the reasons I was shy, and I don't think I was shy, but anyway, one of the reasons I was shy and holding back was because I didn't want to put myself in the forefront, because by being Jewish, I would make myself a target.
That's so interesting.
That is his stuff. That none of that is yours.
Oh, for sure it's his stuff. And I find it's odd that I'm almost defending him for what he said. But I didn't feel threatened or anything. But it was just an odd statement that stuck with me. You know, and I know with things like putting Jewish bumper stickers on the cars, my parents might have been a bit, you don't know where you're going to be driving. You sure you want to do that? That kind of thing. So there is a sense of masking who we really are. But then on my comedy CV, I've got Jewish references all over the place from Jewish things I've done. So I can't hide it. I don't want to hide it. I talk about it a little bit on stage, but I'm curious to know, in terms of doing the show, Breathe, what was the triggering point that made you go from, I'm dealing with this, I now need to kind of process it on stage as well?
Well, so the story goes, when I got really, really, in a really bad way of my mental health, like my life was at risk. That was like, right about 2016-17, and then 2 years after that, it took me nearly 2 years before I could kind of get back out and do shows again. I made a solo show where I released my first album, it's called Surrender, and I made a solo show also called Surrender, where I just started talking about what I was going through, but I hadn't really come out the other side of it yet. I was still kind of in it, and I was still a bit too scared to really dive into what was happening. And that was 2019. But that show got shortlisted for a mental health award, and it really gave me a lot of confidence to keep talking about this stuff. And meanwhile, there was this moment in that show where we were in Edinburgh Fringe 2019. Yeah, it was the first night of the run. And I talked in the show about what I'd been through, how I'd been suicidal and how I'd made it through. And I was feeling more confident. I was like, can we please just celebrate? And this absolutely huge Scottish person on the front row just stands up and just goes, and kicks their chair away and starts dancing. So my music's really, my shows are really ravey and dancey, even though I like to tell a story with everyone seated. And everyone else just assumed that was what was supposed to happen, and they all just got rid of their chairs and started dancing, and I was like, whoa, this is good. I want to do a show that deliberately does that. So that's kind of how I got this idea for Breathe. I was like, what if I dive really deep into my whole story, my whole journey, and then I can tell the real truth of what happened, which was I'd moved to this really sleepy village in the Shires to try and kind of clean my act up. I'd been really struggling with alcohol. I'm now 14 years sober, yeah. I was about to become a parent. I just basically shut myself off from this society that I'd moved to. I decided that these people were all straight, white, middle class, judgmental folk, and I was going to have to pretend to be one of them to survive. So I'd hide everything. I'd definitely hide my immigrant and religious status, but I'd hide my work. I'd hide, I went fully into my white first name persona. Mm. And that was the beginning of me getting really, really poorly. By the time I was ready to stay and get better, I realized I was going to have to open up to these people a bit more. And the minute I did, of course they weren't judging me. Of course they're not a bunch of racists. It was me judging them. So as soon as I started opening up a bit about my music, turns out all of these people who I thought were just John from number 23, who works in IT, is actually a raver just like me. So yeah, in my real life story, we ended up having this birthday party where I wasn't really well enough to go out, but they all just flooded in and held me. And we had this kind of celebration of me in my house, this kind of living room rave. It was like a 90s themed party. It was so good. My friend showed up with an 18 inch subwoofer, and it was brilliant.
It sounds amazing.
It was so good. And it was such a turning point in my kind of my journey, because from that I just suddenly felt held in my community. That gave me the strength to kind of be a bit more myself in my day-to-day life, and then gradually I was able to step back out and go back on stage and flower. Anyway, so in the show Breathe, it's the first time I've ever achieved it, because I've always wanted to tell a story with people sitting down, but the music's always been really ravey, and it's just been this kind of conflict. So in this show Breathe, they've all sat down, they've heard the story, they've been on this mad roller coaster journey with me throughout my career, playing at Glastonbury, all of this amazing stuff, but they've had to sit down the whole way through. And then I'm like, look, this is what happened in my living room. Ding dong, oh, the doorbell's gone. Right, you guys are here, come on in. Yeah, and I turn two people into a human door, and everyone has to come into my living room, and they get to have that dance, they get to have that confetti cannon glitterball moment. And it's so emotional. I cry every single night doing this show. It's an absolute joy. It's so much fun.
It sounds awesome, but it's also, I think there's something about just giving yourself the freedom to be authentic that's just a massive release, and people can relate, even if they're not in a place where they're able to do that yet. Being part of that for somebody else is so exhilarating.
Yeah, I think that's why this show's really worked. It won an award in Edinburgh, and then we're about to take it on this 17-date tour in the spring. We're going on another tour in the autumn, and I think that is exactly what's working about this show. Is all I'm asking you to do is witness me, witness the journey that this human's been on, and celebrate this human. This human made it. They nearly didn't. There was nearly two children who didn't have, who'd lost the parent, and it's you really just can't help rooting for that human. I'm gonna cry if I keep talking about that. So you can't help rooting for that human. And it just means that you end up, you know, you really want to celebrate that human. And then that just means you walk away from it thinking, you know, I've got to do at least a small amount of that for myself. I've got to celebrate myself. I've got to be real about who I am. I'm really proud of it.
Good.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much. And thanks for being so open. We're going to change the subject completely.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, we've talked about inappropriate crisps for Jews, and we've talked about your love of Friday night dinners. But Shlo, what are your favourite Jewish food memories?
Yeah, I mean, so my Jewish food story is really diverse because my father's side are Ashkenazi, so there's a whole different set of food to my Arabic, Sephardi, Iraqi mother's side. So on the Iraqi side, there's lots of like, it's like basically Bedouin foods, slow cooked stuff, delicious food. And but then I really love all the Ashkenazi stuff as well, like the chopped liver and the chopped and fried fish and all that. My grandfather would bake challah like every day, and bagels every breakfast. Like, it was a real shock, I think, once I realized that white kids didn't eat all this. Like, I was really sad for them that they didn't have it.
How did you find out?
Like, when you go for a play date or whatever at your friend's house, we just have fish fingers. And I'm like, I love fish fingers, but do you not have all of this stuff that we get? No, you don't.
What if your fish fingers in hummus?
Yeah, like, I kind of felt sad for, like, that sounds really... I don't mean that in like a judgmental way or a superior way, but I just wanted everyone to have all the stuff that I loved, I guess.
I don't know if you've seen any of those videos. I think they're on YouTube of people who aren't Jewish trying Jewish foods like the filter fish and whatever, and how disgusting they find it. If it's not your palate, you're not brought up with it, then it could be quite a challenging experience.
But also there is a British way of not welcoming other cultural foods. I mean, if you go on holiday somewhere, you'll go to a lovely restaurant and there'll still be the Brits ordering the steak and chips.
Yeah. And like, well, you know, it's all good. You do you. But like, I can't imagine not liking that kind of food.
Do you have like a preference between like the Sephardic Jewish food and the Ashkenazi Jewish food?
No, I love both. I think I end up eating more of the Sephardi side because that tends to be like, my mum still cooks a lot of it and my dad learned to cook a lot of it, and they're both really amazing cooks. But my dad still will make the Ashkenazi stuff as well, if you ask him.
How's his challah? Did you say he makes challah every day? Or was that his, your grandfather? Father did,
my grandfather, yeah. My dad still makes bread every day, but he makes like, he's gone all sourdough. Lockdown just turned everyone into sourdough experts. It's really
nice. Yeah, my brother-in-law started making sourdough challah, which sounded like a bad thing because we shouldn't be innovating challah. Challah is like, you know,
it's a tradition.
It's a tradition and it's perfect. But actually, between you and me and whoever's listening, it's quite nice, the sourdough challah.
Yeah, my dad's made that couple of times.
Is it better than the bagel challah you've had in the past?
God forbid, and I am so upset that you even raised it. Oh my god, Shlo, this is one of the most triggering things that people can say to me, who knows it. It was like a proper trauma, and it's now, I'm not exaggerating, maybe 12 or 13 years ago that happened.
Was it like a giant challah or in the shape of a bagel?
No, it's the opposite, in that it's a giant challah shaped like a challah, but it was made of bagel dough and like bagels. I don't say bagel for bagels because they're bagels for me, being from Essex, but this was an abomination, so I'm happy to bagel it up. yeah, the bagel challah, it was the worst. I just want you to picture, because you said you love Friday night, so that you can experience my pain. Friday night, you've sat down to dinner, you've said yourself it's one of your favorite elements of being Jewish. It's same for me. You've got the, you know, the soups on, everything's ready, all the gorgeous food, and you cut into the challah, you put it in your mouth, you're thinking, well, I'm going to dip it in my soup, it's going to be fantastic, and put it in your mouth and you're tasting bagel.
Oh god, that's going to be all rubbery. And
I think it must be the equivalent of expecting a bowl of chicken soup and someone's made turkey soup.
No, stop. Yeah, it's just wrong. Traumatic.
Right, because it's still the same sort of family. Like, it's still dough. It's still, but they've used the wrong dough.
I can see why it's just triggering, Rach.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you. Thank you. That's so nice. It's really like, it's also just because it ruins that whole Shabbat for me. And it also means that, you know, like, if, I mean, a bit like we also get it, or like, let's say if you think you've got a glass of lemonade, but you pick up the wrong one and it's water and it's just the wrong thing that you put in your mouth. And then it always makes you hesitate a tiny bit when you have that thing. And now I always bite the challah because I'm not running that risk again, my friends. Like, that's...
No. Take control.
But you're not now really excited when you eat a bagel in case it's made of challah dough.
That one would work better. Well, you can get those little
mini challah roll.
Yeah, challah roll. They're yummy. They're really nice.
Yeah, I love a challah roll. I think
they're like independent creatures. They're not each other. I mean, I could do a political rant about this, but it's like any foods. If that's the food you want, if you're in the mood for a challah roll, that's the right thing to eat. If you're in the mood for a bagel, that's the right thing to eat. You could put the same fillings in, but I don't feel like they're the same. They're like apples and oranges. They're both fruit, but they fulfill different functions in your taste buds. Shlo's nodding now, very emphatic. I've never felt so seen as I have in this conversation. I think Philip's frozen for a minute, and that's God punishing him for bringing up the bagel challah. He brings it up a lot. We've worked together for years and years, so we know all each other's buttons. Yeah. And he does like to press that button. I haven't been to your shows because I can't be around strobing and flashing lights, and they contain lots of lighting effects, but I've always wanted to. And eventually you're going to release Breathe as a video, do you think?
We've actually got a gorgeous film of it. We just haven't figured out what to do with it.
So maybe when that comes out, then maybe I'll be able to kind of just listen rather than, because I think to come to something like that and not be able to like see it if you're there in person, because I've been to some shows where I've just put like a blindfold thing on, which is also kind of amazing because it's a different experience. Yeah. But I think to come to something where the lighting is so much part of the performance and seems a bit of a waste.
I feel like I really want to do an accessible version of Breathe because there's so many people who haven't been able to come because of photosensitivity. And it's and like the lighting design is a big part of it, but you could totally adapt it. So I think, watch this space. It's something that
cool.
The whole thing's about inclusivity. The whole vibe is about like, everyone should come as they are. So we need to make sure we do a version of that.
Well,
the interesting thing about the blindfolding thing, I once did a gig for the Royal Society of the Blind where everyone had to be blindfolded. It was so amazing. Empowering to do a gig where no one was actually looking at me. It was brilliant.
Well, Philip's back now. Okay.
Hello again. What did I miss?
It's about
Rich
nothing
just you want for 10 minutes straight.
It's conversation.
Yeah, love it. I love a bit of bagel bagels. No, I'm joking. We've already had quite a bit of talk about bagel or bagel, even to the point where Rachel herself has switched camps and is now saying bagel, which I'm very excited about. But we know it's a big feud between lots of people. Jews love a feud. So we wanted to know, Shlo, if you had any arguments that you were a part of or just that you're aware of that you wanted to share with us now.
Yeah, it's just an annoyingly Jewish stereotype, isn't it? To be Bruges. I think it's not really a feud, but sort of unexpected. I unexpectedly was a victim of racial abuse at a Jewish event from a Jew. Okay.
Wow.
So maybe this is darker than what you were hoping, but it was really hard because it was the very first, one of the very first things I'd done after lockdown. It was, remember when you were allowed, like, I think it was like 30 people or something were allowed to get together, and it was a bar mitzvah for some very well-off person in, a very well-off part of Manchester. And I'd done my piece that I do about my Sephardi family, and the belly dancer comes in and I'm 3 years old and I start belly dancing around, and everyone's, it's an amazing way to get any crowd to just party in like 3 minutes flat. And I had all this lovely stuff from all the mums being like, oh, it's so great for our 13-year-olds to, have someone, a role model like you who's talking about Judaism in a positive way. I was like, yeah, lovely. Anyway, so then it's like the end of the night and I'm DJing, and everyone's quite drunk by this point. Someone comes up to me and they're like, play the Prodigy. Right, so by this point, I've already played 3 Prodigy songs and I'm wearing a t-shirt that says The Prodigy, literally. And I've only got one song left, and I'm going to play You Got the Love by Candy Staton. And I'm like, I can't play The Prodigy right now. I've already played some. I'm going to play this. And he goes, all right, play The Prodigy, you beeping Ashkenazi. And I was like, whoa, what do you mean? He was like, are you being an Ashkenazi? I was like, bro, I'm half Ashkenazi, I'm half Sephardi. Like, this is not okay. And he wouldn't back down. I just think he'd got it in his head that because he's Sephardi and I'm Sephardi, that's okay. But I mean, even if we were, it's not okay. Why do people need to speak like that? Especially when they're drunk.
Wow. He's obviously got a deep-seated issue with that Ashki society. But what had that got to do with the Prodigy? Like, what was
exactly
the connection?
Yeah, that's the thing I'm wondering. Why?
This is the only insult we could think of.
Was it a particular Prodigy song?
He wasn't saying play X song. He was just saying play the Prodigy. I'm like, I already played Firestarter. Pay attention.
That sounds like the sort of thing I would hang on to for the rest of my life, that interaction.
I feel like, you know, younger me would have quietly tried to hide the pain of whatever that sensation was of someone using the term Ashkenazi in a derogatory way. But I'm done. I just call it out now. I'm like, it's not okay. No, stop. And hopefully he won't say something like that to someone again. It's just unnecessary. Yeah, so there you go. There's my feud.
That is such a bizarre thing to say to somebody. Because it's got no reference to anything you were actually doing.
I know. And also, there's not that many circles that I can even tell that story where people are like, what do you mean? What's the difference?
Oh. Well, this is your home for that story.
Yay! Yeah, all the Jewish listeners, you understand.
Well, it could be that that person's listening in and hopefully they feel massive regret for their terrible behaviour at that event. Because Jews,
I highly doubt they'll even remember they were so drunk. They probably don't even remember.
I was just thinking that all Jews are connected. We're all super connected. And if you think of the idea of 6 degrees of can't eat bacon, other than maybe like Philip and I, who's your most interesting personal Jewish connection?
There's a lot of sort of Jewish creatives that don't necessarily make the Judaism a big part of their thing, but there's this sort of little nod of solidarity when I meet them. So like one of my beatboxing superstar peers is Beardy Man, who's also a North London Jew.
Have you gigged with Beardy Man?
Yeah. Like years and years of just growing up in the same scene, I think. There used to be a little bit of a healthy rivalry, and then, I think we've both mellowed out, and now we're just quite close these days. It's really great.
That's really fab. Do you feel like your Jewishness kind of brings you together in the work?
I don't know. I think there's sort of just quite a lot of overlap in our identities. I remember calling him and being like, oh, I've just been diagnosed with ADHD, age 37, and he was like, obviously, don't you think beatboxing is just obviously a symptom of ADHD? And beatboxers have it. I was like,
oh. It's just stimming. Right. That's it.
I do a show for kids, for families, beatbox adventure for kids, and it's so glorious because I just get up on stage and just talk about all the same stuff I talk about in the grown-up show, just a slightly more child-friendly way of saying it. But I kind of say, look, I'm disabled and I get confused and I forget things, so you're all going to have to be my support workers. And it just feels like a real joyous way of sort of celebrating neurodiversity. Anyway, after the show, I always cry after every of those shows as well, because I get these cues of kids coming up to me being like, I've got ADHD too, I've got autism too. And it's like, yeah, high five. And I'm like, that's such a different attitude to you know, what it was like for me growing up. It's really emotional, it's really beautiful.
It's like all the cool kids have it.
Yeah.
I also had, like, when I said to my family, do you think I should get formally tested? And they were like, it's really not worth spending the money.
Well, it depends though. It depends, because I get a lot of support now, which is worth way more than what I've spent on the diagnosis. Oh, he's gone.
Yeah, he's gone again. I'm conscious of the time, so I think I'm just going to ask the next question. So, Shlo, in this section, which we like to call Duolingo, do you have a particular favourite Jewish or Yiddish or Hebrew expression that tickles your fancy and that you'd like to share?
Well, I don't think it's Hebrew or Yiddish. I think it's Arabic. But my favourite phrase growing up is yalla, which just means get on with it. Come on, yalla, yalla, let's go, yalla.
That's definitely been adopted as a kind of Hebrew/Jewish. I don't want to get into a whole appropriation scenario, but I think yalla also has a Hebrew connotation. And
yeah, it's my favourite.
Sorry about that. Well, that's nearly all we've got time for, but how will our audience know what you're up to if you never call, you don't write? Normally, we'd allocate 20 seconds to do this, but for you, 30.
You can find me on social media. We're going on tour with my show Breathe. We're also launching a pilot youth program called Breathe Academy, aiming to fight suicide in young people in partnership with the charity Calm, which is a suicide helpline. And the idea is just get young people to tell their stories in the same way that I'm doing in the show. So that's really exciting. If you've got young, we want to get all kind of marginalized young people to come forward. So definitely Jewish kids. Also social media at SK Shlomo on all of those, skshlomo.com. Come say hi. We've got a really thriving online WhatsApp community where people sort of look out for each other. Again, it's all just about fighting suicide by being your true self.
Sounds amazing. Can I just check the tour? If it's coming kind of locally and we did like a Jew talking outing to come and see you, do I have to get up and dance?
You don't have to.
Excellent.
You very likely will find that you suddenly need to, and I don't know.
That's all right.
Okay.
No, you don't have to. I just would be surprised if you didn't.
Let's do it.
Well, I've absolutely loved this, and we'll now always think of Shlomo as the Jew whose grandfather made challah, but empathise with my hatred of an unexpected bagel.
And as my grandmother used to say when she wanted to end my telephone calls, you must have better things to do than talk to me, and you must have better things to do than talk to us, which is a good thing, as sadly we've come to the end of this week's show. We'd like to thank our guests, the fabulous SK Shlomo. Follow them on social media.
Follow us on social media at Jew Talking without the G.
Don't forget to subscribe, like, and share the podcast with everyone you know.
And join us next time on Jew Talking to Me.
Jew Talking to Me was hosted by me, Philip Simon.
And me, Rachel Krieger.
It was produced by Russell Wolkin and judged by our mothers. Well, we hope you enjoyed that episode. Once again, we wanted to highlight the issues that we had been speaking about around mental health and suicide. If anyone wants more information about the charity that Shlomo mentioned, which was CALM, Campaign Against Living Miserably, the website is thecalmzone.net, and we'll put details of it on the show notes as well.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you next time.
Bye-bye.